Picture this. You're holding, I don't know, your absolute favorite ceramic coffee mug.
Oh, I can see where this is going.
Right. And it just slips. It slips right through your fingers, hits the kitchen floor, and shatters into 100 pieces. Coffee goes literally everywhere.
A tragedy.
A total tragedy. But here's a fact that absolutely breaks my brain. If you look at the fundamental laws of classical physics, like the exact mathematical equations written by Isaac Newton or Albert Einstein,
Yeah.
there was actually nothing in that math that forbids those ceramic shards from spontaneously jumping off the floor, reassembling perfectly,
Yeah.
and just, leaping back into your hand.
It's true. I mean, the math works perfectly well in reverse. According to those classical equations, time doesn't really have an arrow.
Right, but obviously shattered mugs don't fix themselves. You can't unfry an egg.
Sadly, no.
Exactly. So today we are trying to answer the biggest question in reality, which is why does time only move forward?
It's such a massive topic.
It really is. We're taking a deep dive into this profound shift in how we understand existence itself. We're moving from this old idea of a static, predictable universe, a universe of just, well, being, to one that is defined by chaos, creation, and continuous change, a universe of becoming.
And our mission today is to really simply and clearly explain how this works. We're going to break down the basic principles of process philosophy and look at the revolutionary role of Ilya Prigozhin in proving this.
Because this isn't just some abstract philosophical debate, right?
No, not at all. Prigozhin actually won a Nobel Prize for the physics that proved this. We're marrying hard science with one of the most ancient ways of viewing the world.
So for you listening, if you've ever felt like your life is less like a predictable clock and more like a turbulent waterfall.
Which I think is most of us.
Yeah, exactly. Well, science and philosophy finally agree with you. We're going to explore how order emerges from chaos and why you, fundamentally, are a verb, not a noun.
I love that framing. A verb, not a noun.
Right. But to really appreciate how radical this idea of becoming is, we kind of have to start by looking at the worldview it destroyed.
The old classical clockwork universe.
Exactly. For centuries, science treated reality like this giant, flawless machine.
Yeah, you think about the mathematician Pierre-Simon Laplace. He proposed this super famous thought experiment known as Laplace's demon.
Oh, right, the super intellect.
Exactly. He argued that if this hypothetical super intellect knew the precise location and momentum of literally every single atom in the universe right now,
Like a snapshot of everything.
yeah, a perfect snapshot. And if it understood all the forces acting upon those atoms, then the entire future would be completely unveiled before its eyes. Like nothing would be uncertain at all.
So it's pure determinism, the idea that the universe is basically just playing out a pre-written script.
Right. A rigid mechanism.
Okay, let's unpack this,
Yeah.
because that brings us back to my shattered coffee mug. If everything is just this perfectly reversible mathematical clockwork, where does the messy, irreversible experience of real life actually fit in?
Well, under that classical view, it kind of doesn't.
Right. Like, think about that mechanical duck mentioned in our sources, the one built by the inventor Reichsteiner back in 1837.
The automaton. Yeah.
Yeah, it was this absolute marvel of clockwork engineering. I mean, it could waddle, it could flap its wings, it even mimic eating grain.
But it was entirely dead.
Exactly. It couldn't grow, it couldn't, heal a broken wing, it couldn't evolve. It was just this incredibly complex looping gif.
And what's really fascinating here is how classical physicists dealt with that glaring discrepancy. I mean, the difference between a mechanical duck and a real living duck.
They just kind of ignored it, didn't they?
They basically gaslit us for centuries. They argued that irreversibility, the fact that things age, break, die, they said it was just an illusion born out of human ignorance.
Wait, really? Just an illusion.
Yeah. They claimed that what we call disorder was just a label we put on things when the math got too complicated for our puny human brains to track.
So they were basically saying, like, if we just had a powerful enough computer to track all the molecules in the fried egg, we could reverse engineer it back into a raw egg.
That was exactly the assumption. They thought if you just break the grand structures of the universe down to their smallest bricks, you understand the whole building.
Was the pile of bricks.
Right. But they were completely ignoring the mortar. They were ignoring the architecture of time itself.
Which perfectly sets up the guy who finally shattered that illusion, Ilya Prigozhin.
Yes.
He won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1977, and his work fundamentally proved that the one-way flow of time is not just some human illusion, it is a foundational feature of the cosmos.
And he did this by staring directly into the concept of entropy, you know, the second law of thermodynamics.
Right, which is basically the rule that the universe is inevitably winding down.
Moving from order to disorder, exactly. Yeah. Heat dissipates, mountains erode, things fall apart. This is what establishes the arrow of time. Time only flows in the direction of increasing entropy.
And Prigogine was super adamant about this. He famously said, I have the quote here, "Irreversibility is either true on all levels or on none."
Which makes perfect sense.
Right. Like, you can't have a universe where the math says time is reversible, but the actual physical reality we live in says it isn't.
But, and this is a big but, that creates a massive glaring paradox.
Yeah, it does. Because if the supreme law of the universe is that everything is crumbling into chaotic disorder, mm-hmm. how are you and I sitting here having a coherent conversation?
Exactly. How does the incredible, intricate order of a biological organism even happen if the universe just wants chaos?
That is the exact paradox Prigogine solved.
Yeah.
And he did it by discovering what he called dissipative structures.
Yeah. And to really understand this simply, we should look at his metaphor. Imagine a closed room where the air temperature has completely leveled out.
Okay. Like no drafts, no hot spots.
Right. It's at thermodynamic equilibrium. At that state, the molecules are just bouncing around randomly. Prigogine called them sleepwalkers.
Sleepwalkers. I like that.
Because they have no connection to each other. They're totally oblivious.
They're just doing their own random thing. It's totally uniform and totally dead.
But watch what happens when you push a system far away from equilibrium. Imagine taking a shallow pan of oil and putting it on a hot stove.
So you're pumping energy into it.
Massive flows of energy. Heat is entering the system from the outside. The oil molecules at the bottom get hot and want to rise, while the cool ones at the top want to sink.
So it gets super chaotic.
It does, but only until it hits a critical point. Suddenly, out of that intense chaos, those sleepwalking molecules wake up.
What do you mean, wake up?
They spontaneously organize themselves into these perfect hexagonal convection cells. Millions of molecules start moving together in a coordinated macroscopic dance just to dissipate the heat.
Oh, wow. So the chaos is actually what creates the order.
Precisely. The influx of energy forces the system to organize to handle the stress.
That is wild. And there's an even crazier example of this in the sources. The Belousov-Zhabotinsky chemical clock.
Oh, I love this one.
Yeah, if you just mix these specific, completely lifeless chemicals in a petri dish, you'd logically expect them to just react, fizzle out, and turn into this murky brown sludge.
That would be equilibrium, yeah.
But instead, the liquid starts pulsing. It turns red, then blue, then red again. It creates these perfect rhythmic concentric rings radiating outward. It literally looks like a beating heart.
And those chemicals are communicating across macroscopic distances to create that pattern. It's not random.
Right. And these are dissipative structures. A hurricane is a dissipative structure. It's just a pattern of wind organizing itself to dissipate the heat of the ocean.
And fundamentally, a human being is a dissipative structure.
Yes. Because we take in massive amounts of energy like food, water, sunlight, just to maintain our highly complex, far from equilibrium bodies.
And notice the profound irony here. The energy flow that keeps us away from equilibrium is the exact same force that drives entropy and instability in the universe. Yet, according to Prigogine, that very instability is the sole source of complex life. You cannot have biological order without the constant threat of chaos pushing you far from equilibrium.
That is incredible. And Prigogine said he wasn't studying the static laws of being, he was studying the laws of becoming.
Which is such a powerful shift in perspective.
It really is.
Yeah.
And it completely bridges the gap between hard physics and a philosophical framework that has actually been saying this exact thing for thousands of years.
Right. Process philosophy.
Yeah. Because if physics proves that a hurricane is really just a temporary pattern of moving air, at what point do we stop calling it a solid thing and start calling it an event?
Well, process philosophy traces this idea all the way back to ancient Greece, specifically to Heraclitus.
The river guy.
The river guy, exactly. He coined the phrase panare, which means everything flows. He gave us that famous proverb that you cannot step into the same river twice.
Because obviously by the time you step in again, new water has flowed past. It's quite literally a different river.
And honestly, your cells have changed in that time too, so you're technically a different person stepping into it.
Exactly. Heraclitus argued that reality isn't made of solid, unchangeable substances. It is a volatile flux. He actually used fire as a symbol for reality.
Because fire isn't an object. You can't put a flame in a box and keep it. It's a continuous process of consuming and transforming.
Right. And fast forward to the 20th century, the philosopher Alfred North Whitehead takes this ancient idea and builds a really rigorous modern framework around it.
In his 1929 book, Process and Reality, yeah.
Yeah, Whitehead completely tossed out that old Aristotelian idea that the universe is just a collection of static objects bumping into each other.
He proposed that the fundamental building blocks of reality aren't atoms or physical stuff. They are what he called actual entities or occasions of experience.
Okay, I really want to make sure we nail this concept simply because it's a bit of a mind bender. What exactly is an occasion of experience?
Let's think of it as a microscopic event rather than a microscopic object. An occasion of experience is a fleeting moment where a subject reacts to its environment.
Okay.
It takes in the data of the immediate past Whitehead called this prehending the past. It reacts to it, it becomes fully realized for just a split second, and then it instantly perishes.
And then it becomes the past for the next occasion.
Exactly. He called this process of coming together concrescence.
Concrescence. Okay, so basically, I'm understanding this. A human being isn't a solid, unchanging 3D statue that just glides through time.
Not at all.
You are actually a cascading series of overlapping events. You are a continuously updating process. You, the listener, are quite literally a verb, not a noun.
That is the perfect way to phrase it.
Yeah.
You are a historically connected sequence of these occasions of experience.
I love dwelling on that for a second because it's, I don't know, it's incredibly freeing.
How so?
Well, think about the immense cultural pressure we all have to find yourself, as if your identity is this buried treasure chest. Right. A static noun just waiting to be dug up.
Oh, right.
But process philosophy says no. You are creating yourself second by second. You aren't stuck.
And connecting this back to the bigger picture, this completely obliterates the old Laplace's demon idea of determinism.
It totally does.
Because if reality is a continuous state of becoming, where every single occasion of experience reacts to the past and injects a tiny bit of novelty into the present, then the universe is inherently non-deterministic.
The future is not written.
No. Free will, creativity, and novelty are baked into the fundamental fabric of reality. It directly mirrors Prigozhin's rejection of the clockwork universe.
But wait, let me push back a bit here. If the universe is a continuous process of becoming, how does it actually decide what to become next? Like, if we aren't just following a clockwork script, how does this system choose its future?
To answer that, we have to look at the mathematics of chaos. We need to talk about bifurcation points.
Okay, let's set the stage with something really concrete. Imagine the smoke rising from a cigarette resting in an ashtray.
A classic example in chaos theory.
Right. For the first few inches, the smoke rises in a perfectly smooth, straight, totally predictable line.
Because that's the system operating near equilibrium. But as the smoke gets higher, it accelerates. It's being pushed further and further from equilibrium by the heat differential.
And then it gets messy.
Exactly. Eventually, it hits a critical threshold, a literal fork in the road. This is a bifurcation point.
Right. Suddenly, that smooth line of smoke shatters into wild, swirling, unpredictable eddies. And the specific way it swirls is decided at that precise fork in the road.
And here is the truly fascinating part about bifurcation points. At that critical threshold, the system becomes incredibly hypersensitive.
Sensitive to what?
To everything. The choice of which path the smoke takes, whether it swirls left or right, is often triggered by an infinitesimally small, random microscopic fluctuation.
Like a single air molecule bump in it.
Exactly. Or a tiny fraction of a degree shift in temperature. It's so universal that in the new science of complexity, the mathematician Mitchell Feigenbaum even discovered a universal constant.
Oh, yeah. It's roughly 4.669, right?
Right. It's a mathematical constant that governs the exact speed at which systems double their patterns and cascade into chaos. It's almost like a universal speed limit for unpredictability.
So a tiny, completely random flutter decides the fate of the entire macro system.
Yes.
But here is the real kicker. Once that system chooses a path at the bifurcation point, all the other potential futures that branch from the unchosen path are permanently lost.
They're gone. If the smoke swirls left, the reality where it swirled right is inaccessible forever. The choice is irreversible.
But hold on, I'm struggling with this a bit. You're saying the system makes irreversible choices and moves forward, essentially creating a history.
Right.
But physics is mostly just math and energy. Where does this history actually live? I mean, math doesn't have a diary. A carbon atom doesn't have a memory of what it was doing yesterday. So how does a physical system have a history?
That raises such an important question. And the answer is that the history is the physical structure itself.
Wait, what do you mean?
Think about the spatial layout of an ancient city like Rome or London.
Okay, super confusing streets.
Right. Those winding, totally illogical streets aren't the result of some master mathematical plan. They are the physical, fossilized memory of thousands of individual, irreversible choices made by people centuries ago.
Oh, like where to put a wall or where to route a cart.
Exactly. The physical structure is the memory. Or look at biological organisms. Your DNA is a physical record of the evolutionary bifurcation choices your ancestors' environments forced upon them.
Oh, wow. Never thought about it like that.
Remember those classical systems we talked about earlier? The sleepwalkers at equilibrium?
Yeah.
They actually forget their initial conditions. If you leave a cup of hot coffee in a room, it eventually cools to room temperature. But once it hits room temperature, you cannot look at that coffee and tell if it started out boiling hot or if it was just lukewarm.
Because all that historical information is erased by equilibrium.
Right. But complex dissipative systems like you, me, or a city, we encode our irreversible history into our very physical form. Your scars, your immune system, your memories, you are the physical record of your system's past choices.
That is incredibly profound. Which means to make a choice at a bifurcation point inherently means to reject another path. In order to become something, you have to actively not become a million other things.
Yes, and that brings us to the final and maybe the most mind-bending concept we're covering today, the theoretical leap known as the principle of systematic exclusion, or PSE.
Which comes from the contemporary essays by HCHJ Salting in Our Sources.
Exactly. PSE states that any coherent system, whether it's a physical storm, a biological cell, or even human cognition, can only exist or generate knowledge by systematically excluding a vast range of alternative possibilities.
Which is so counterintuitive because we usually define things by what they include, right? Like a car is defined by having an engine, wheels, and a steering wheel.
But PSE flips that completely. It says stability actually comes from restricting what gets in. Differentiation is exclusion.
So when a system forms an identity, it has to draw a boundary. It has to declare, I am this, which means I am actively excluding all of that.
Right. It's the absolute primordial axiom underlying Prigozhin's arrow of time. You can't have a direction unless you firmly close off the paths behind you. And Stolting uses this wonderfully evocative term for those excluded, inaccessible paths.
Darwin's dragons.
Darwin's dragons,
I
yes.
love that term. They're the evolutionary ghosts, the biological or historical possibilities that just no longer exist within the system.
But they define the system's boundaries by their very absence. The borders of who you are right now are defined by the dragons you locked outside the gates.
So what does this all mean for us on a daily basis? Because it seems like it has massive implications for how we process reality as humans.
It definitely does. Our cognitive systems use what Stolting calls a holoscript, which is basically a network of concepts and mental models we use to make sense of the world.
Right.
But to construct a coherent worldview, your brain has to actively hide almost all of the universe's infinite chaos from your conscious mind.
It's like applying a filter to a photograph so you can actually see the subject instead of just blinding white light.
Exactly. Our cognitive blind spots aren't flaws. They aren't signs of stupidity. They are structural necessities.
Because if we didn't systematically exclude 99% of the sensory and chaotic data bombarding us every second, our minds would just dissolve into static. We need the boundaries to stay sane.
Attempting to capture every possible truth and include every single variable within a single perfect system just leads to total collapse. We exist because we differentiate. We exist because we exclude.
Okay, let's tie all of these massive threads together for the listener, because this really changes how you look at the world. To be truly well-informed today, you have to abandon that comforting, predictable Newtonian clock.
The universe is not a rigid machine slowly winding down.
No, it is a waterfall of continuous creation. It is a universe of becoming. We move forward in time because we cannot return to that uniform, sleepwalking state of equilibrium without losing the very complexity that makes us alive.
You, the listener, are a dissipative structure.
You are a localized pocket of brilliant order, feeding on energy, riding the absolute edge of chaos.
You are a cascading series of Whitehead's occasions of experience.
You are a verb.
Yeah.
And your identity, like your physical body, your career, your deepest beliefs, is literally the fossilized memory of the bifurcation paths you chose.
And equally importantly, you are carved out of the marble of the paths you systematically excluded.
It's a slightly dizzying but ultimately beautiful way to view your own life.
It really is.
Which leaves us with one final kind of provocative thought for you to explore on your own as you go about your day. We started by comparing life to a turbulent waterfall, constantly shifting but holding its shape.
Yeah.
If your entire coherent reality, like your sanity, your identity, your physical form, is built entirely upon what you have successfully kept out, what invisible Darwin's dragons are currently shaping your life right now simply by not being there?